You're listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void. The play was called Miss Strigil, and it was written by a man named Arthur Beryl Bain. The play itself consisted of a series of vignettes which displayed man's absolute subjugation to external forces, excepting in the circumstance of intervening magical assistance. I myself had the role of Miss Strigil, and I served as a kind of observer and expositor of events. I was also the interceding hero. I found the play dismal, possibly because I could never find the pearl of my performance. Was Miss Strigil a fool, a savior, a judge, a victim, a cold observer, a strict lesson teacher, hero or anti-hero, Christ or the devil? When asked, Arthur Beryl Bain would only say, "Yes, oh yes, all of these," in his preening, finger-dancing way. In one scene, a businessman is prevented from getting home by a mysterious force. The train never arrives at his station. When he finally debarks, the taxi he hires keeps passing his street. When he tries to walk home, he loses his way. Despite my contempt, it was an artful piece, and it was possible that I felt a shade harder toward it for my depriving it of its full effect. The play ended with these words: "A great accident, or accidentally great." There was lots of bizarre rhetoric like that, wherein Arthur Beryl Bain simply inverted some commonplace string to strange effect. On the page, it didn't ring or sound well, but somehow these queer and vapid reversings threw the audience a turn. I often saw mouths hang open with disbelief at such upside-downings, as though here was the great wisdom for which they had always thirsted. In each of the vignettes, at a point just past the crucial divide, Miss Strigil arrives and offers to switch places with the oppressed victims. Thus, the businessman, when offered, agrees to take Miss Strigil's observer post, while Miss Strigil becomes the man who cannot get home. Thereupon, Miss Strigil is observed by the formerly stymied fellow, but the confounding twist is that Miss Strigil treats his burden as quite the most welcome relief in the world. To not be able to get home is a wonderful thing. Nothing better. Miss Strigil laughs as one thing after another prevents his arrival home. "My street has disappeared," he exclaims. "Aren't I lucky? Isn't this terrific?" This persists until the businessman begs to be returned to his former life, which now seems quite manageable, pleasant even. And of course, Miss Strigil accommodates the request. A dramatic switch-out takes place. Miss Strigil resumes his omniscient post, and the businessman, after a giddy 10 or 15 seconds, crumbles into tears, screaming, raging against the invisible force preventing him from getting home. Miss Strigil smiles, as perhaps the fellow is now even a little more miserable for not being able to sustain his observed bonhomie. Though my portrayal rankled, I yet enjoyed Miss Strigil's costume, his eye mask, his caped, white-gloved, top-hatted, long-caned, and shiny-booted otherliness. He was a kind of Phantom of the Opera and snake-oil salesman, all wrapped in one. The character had no analogue, as far as I could tell, which is to say, to marry Christ and the devil is to produce a kind of chaotic nothing. Every line of dialogue was half-truth, half-lie, and Miss Strigil was meant to speak his lines in such a way that both truth and lie could be felt. Arthur Beryl Bain attended every performance. He was a man of my medium build, with an overly extruded face that had the woven and waxy look of a mask. His large, balding head had a sagging back curtain of baby-like brown hair. Barold Bane liked to think of himself as a man with a good deal of flair, and thus, after any introduction, he rolled out a prepared carpet. "Shall I tell you my weaknesses?" he would start, and without pause he would launch into a false Shakespearean oratory. "I am brief in height and tall in speech, vain of looks, but having none, reveal my ugly, stubborn side. I am short of shoe, you see, and nearly blind. I made believe for far too long, and now it's hard for me to tell. Do you see how imaginary it just became? Just there, right then as I said it? Am I too little here, or you too much there? The thing is that I've only just begun, and yet already there's the dead feeling of the casket in the earth, of the toes being licked over by the fires. But these are weaknesses, and I am committed to them, for that is my sole strength. Please call me Bibi." I was never convinced that Bibi's oddity was meant to serve anything but some artistic project. I saw him only in three poses, writing furiously in the dark theatre, sitting in his corner seat for the performance, and making his peculiar, convivial conversation with the cast or with ambushed strangers. I felt there might be some Romana Clef point to it all, as though he were pressuring mankind with his unusual stimulations to get some even queerer response, that he could mark it all down and birth a new play. At any rate, he didn't care, but seemed to know how poorly his impression registered. The phrase, "I know I'm dreadful," peppered his conversation. It was all managed to a final result that only he knew. Though he was considered a vulgarian and a fop, it was yet granted far and wide, and he had the commendations to back it up, that he could write himself a play. He sat with his plumped-out face and his little rim of brushy brown hair in the rightmost front-row seat, the rest of which row was cordoned from use as it gave poor view to the stage. But Bibi loved it. From his awful nook he could juxtapose performance and audience. At the end of every performance he would clap once, and his hands would glom together, and his head would nest downward into the angled roost. He would raise this clenching slightly in French victory before standing, removing a handkerchief from his pocket, and wiping down the yellow candle wax of his face. He visited each of his performers in turn in the after moments of the show. He would knock, peek in a dressing room, and say in his non sequitur style, "Vital, a singing group to fight off the blues," or, "As cake follows stew, tasty." Perhaps because I played the character of Mistrigiel, whom I quickly gathered was a kind of self-portrait, Bibi saved me for last, and kept me for the longest. "This is a chair," he would say, pointing at the obvious seat in my dressing room. I would not play certain of his games, though I did not mind that he played them. "Yes, I've heard of these," he would mumble when I failed to respond. I found his forced peculiarity deeply interesting, as it was not accidental. I was thus always trying to figure out the meaning of his manner. I have never not been slow in my transition from character to self. It puts a particular strain on my soul to return to my own saddle, as it were. I don't remember the last time I walked home from a performance anything but low and depressed. Removing a character's costume and donning my own dull clothes, a wave of displeasure and disappointment would squirrel down through me, followed by a very disturbing sense of shallowness, as though I were really no one. And yet accompanying this was the feeling of just how great a mass of energy was required to pretend to be me. Why, I wondered, should it take so much more to pretend to be me than Mistrigiel, when so much less was the result? That, in a way, I'd forgotten how to comfortably conform to my own rules. Do I like apples or oranges? Do I walk confidently or crookedly? And more than that, that while I lacked a kind of fundamental interest in being myself, I was constantly trying to muster together the wind to get my old ship sailing. I was without lines, without the certitude of form and story, and to tuck back into the mean penny of life which had such a way of being so drastically plain was to close the door on my own jail cell. So, I would be dressed in full regalia, in the limbo of being, as Beryl Bane would cautiously test the chair in my dark quarters. I kept several candles and meditative aromas, spinning smoke in the chamber so as to soften my transfiguration. Bibi would deglove and shuffle his coats so that he was sitting quite comfortably before starting. "You know, I was thinking," he said, "of actually finally doing a play that had an ounce of truth in it. What would you say? Do you believe me? Do you say I could do it?" "I would say," I said, "in what way does the current play lack this ounce?" "There's not a grain of truth in it, not a smack or a dab. But of course it hits home. It drives its fair nothings right into the pretty nowhere, which is what we prefer to feel and where we prefer to reside. There's a great thirst for this sort of soothing untruth. Surely you understand me?" When I told Beryl Bane that I didn't quite follow him, I realized that he had strangely adopted my seated pose, as though to somehow test the waters of my confusion by aligning his ligaments to my own. As I shifted one leg down and peeled my toe upward, so too did he. Curiously, despite this imitation, I noted that he had, since taking his seat, been much less false than normal. The persona had been set aside, it seemed, and I felt, in the powerful dropping of his mask, that he was about to make a dramatic offer of some kind, that, despite my own misgivings, I would not be capable of refusing. Bang continued. "My play, as almost every piece of art, is a lie. The notions of cause and effect, Sherwin, are reversed. What is real is made false, and what is false real. That is the dream of our experience, and what we like to have supported. Is it the fact of the intervening and wicked family squabble that prevents the lovely Juliet from settling with her lovely Romeo, or the way in which they choose to perceive it?" "Are you suggesting," I said, "that Shakespeare is incorrect?" "Not at all. People kill themselves all the time and for lesser things. only to suggest that his lesson does not point toward the larger picture, but toward the bald and simple and persisting romantic condition of what may be considered a problem, and the dramatic resolutions obtainable. And by that, I mean it's pretty fiction, but has nothing to do with real meaning. It's a false story that supports a false belief system, which is why we like it. I am sure many have killed themselves because of this portrait, and what I'm saying is that there is a deeper truth, and were that deeper truth wrung out by Sir William, Romeo and Juliet would have had quite a nice life. Maybe not together, and obviously the play may have been dull. But I'm saying we are surrounded by convincing romances of all kinds that support the untrue, that provide convincing arguments for this and for that, but contain always a fundamental flaw in perspective. How we see ourselves beset is really just how we beset ourselves. The world has no power over us, Sherwin, only that we give it such. If we were not pretend creatures, we would not so deeply care for pretend things. But we need them, like life rafts. I meant to push along some line or other as regards to his arrogant stance on Shakespeare, but before I could, he said, "May I presume to judge you as friendless?" I hesitated, only to give the impertinence of the question a sabbatical form of effrontery. "You may," I said. "May I presume to suggest that you qualify this state by saying that none likes you well enough?" "I have not dwelled in it for some time," I said, "but that may have been my original conceit. You may have noticed that I enjoy a certain kind of reversing rhetoric. What I would thus say to you is that it is not that people do not like you, but that you do not like them, and that what you have seen on the stage and elsewhere in the arts has confirmed the integrity of the original perspective for you, that the center of the problem is external to your person, that when bad things occur, the action is to look outside oneself to find the criminal. Who did this to me? It is always others. It is always outside. The message is constantly reinforced. It is one of the most basic and banal lies of our enormous conversation. The truth is that all problems are internal and imaginary. The real and final and utter truth is that there is no such thing as a problem. It is easy to see that problems themselves, as they are perceived, do not result in a universal absolute reaction. One man is late for the office and wants to cut his own throat. Another is late for the office and is not put out in the least. The fact that the same problem exists for both gentlemen, yet results in two very different reactions, is proof that so-called problems are of an imaginary consistency. If it were not so, the reaction would be the same. Where one man feels fire, one man feels nothing. We paint our world as we see fit. Which brings me to my point, Sherwin. You are not enjoying your portrayal of Miss Strigil. I enjoy it, quite fully. In fact, your discomfiture brings the perfect blood to the performance, although you could not guess this. But I would like to suggest that I relieve you of your burden for one night. "Cancel the play," I said. "Of course not. I will take up the role. You will take up mine. I will be Miss Strigil, and you will be Arthur Barrelbane. Just like the play, you and I will switch places. The burden of the performance will be on my shoulders, while you will be given the freedom of its observation. Now, my condition is that we continue on in this manner. I will return home to your apartment as you, and you, following my former course, will follow me back to your apartment." "You have been following me back to my apartment," I said, filling with a strange feathery fear and excitement rather than outrage. "More than that, I have been following you into your room. I have been watching you every night. I leave shortly after you fall asleep." "Impossible," I said. It was inconceivable that I could have been anything but alone in my apartment all these nights. To answer this, B.B. stood. He removed his jacket, tie, and shirt. Beneath these, I saw that he wore a tight black gown. He took from his pocket a set of black gloves and drew a black mask down over his face. "The Hanalekin," Arthur Barrelbane said, "as you may have guessed, and as you will soon see, works quite well in such circumstances where one would prefer not to be seen. In fact, where one would prefer not to be at all." I was thrown deeply. An involuting violence seemed to be overtaking me, a kind of agreement to the theft of my person. would I be willing to agree to be the subject of, in fact, to have a hand in, a kind of metaphysical robbery. It was as though Beryl Bayne knew that I was built toward this weakness, that throwing off the yoke of self was something every cell in my body yearned for. Arthur Beryl Bayne continued, "Not only will I be performing as Mistrigio, I will be performing as Sherwin's Sleeves. It is an incredible gift I offer, though I realize it does not seem so now, and I will take a step further. Just as in the play, you will have the option of continuing on in the observer's post, or we may switch back as you see fit." "And when," I asked, "would it end?" "Oh, it need never end," Arthur Beryl Bayne said. We had left for the evening. Bibi suggested drinks at a place he called the Alley. "They serve grog," he said, "and other old-fashioned drinks from hundreds of years ago. They all taste like poison, of course, but it's quite gripping." The Alley was located down a thin, black street, not quite an alley, but a cobbled way with darkened homes and a strip of starry skies above us. A single lamp burned over the door, and we stepped down through granite blocks into a kind of dungeon. There were several other older women and fellows here in the drowsy quiet, all of whom nodded with some knowing toward my host. We took a candlelit table near a rock-pile wall. "If you're ever in trouble, come here," he whispered. I looked around the room. I did not ask, nor could I be absolutely sure, but this statement, coupled with the secret garment he wore, seemed to confirm for me that all within the bar was stalwarts. Drinks came without request. An old green labelless bottle that looked as though it had floated in the ocean for 100 years was set down with 2 wooden cups. Beryl Bayne took a sip. "Poachin," he said. As I drank and my head splashed whitely with the grainy gasoline, he continued, "It is almost never the case that we get to put our lives down. I am not necessarily asking you to put down the unputdownable, but rather asking if you would be interested in seeing what happened if I picked it up. You will secure, I guarantee it, a reflection that you could never otherwise. Yourself, alive, in action, yourself on the stage and on the stage of life, no longer in the first person. To bring it to business, Sherwin, it will be important for your coming work with the Stalwarts to divest yourself of yourself. If you cannot, if you must be Sherwin's Sleeves with all the I's dotted and T's crossed, you will not be able to operate in any of the coming higher formats. Yet, as we both know, it is the case that you do." "And how is it," I asked, "that we know this?" You are the author of a particular book yet to be written, Sherwin. Streamlines of the Futurist. If you are the author of that book, then I can only say it is highly likely that you will shortly agree to go along with this plan, to switch with me, which really renders pointless any further need for me to convince you. Beryl Bane stood, took the old bottle into his hands. I think we are agreed, and I don't think you need any further clarification. I live in the Claridge House at 70 Windsor. He dropped his heavy keys on the table. I felt in my pockets to find my own. I already have yours, Sherwin. The full switch will commence at 5:30 tomorrow night. We can meet in your dressing room. Consider tonight and tomorrow a little light transition. Obviously, you should make yourself feel at home at Claridge House. Beryl Bane leaned forward and patted my shoulder, then poured me a full cup of the cold, scalding alcohol before pocketing the old sea bottle. I'm sure you're wearing the pajamas, he said, drawing the Hunalikan mask from his pocket. It was not quite a question. And as he left, I brought the drink to my lips. I had, perhaps due to some light drunkenness, a great sense of relief. I was amazed that I was, in the face of so much intercutting nonsense, of so much fantastical brocading, deeply and perfectly peaceful. It was as though it all made sense to me, and that nothing needed sorting out, that I must follow forward on the experience, and that taking each next step was the only explanation I needed, and the only one I would ever understand. As I left the alley, Bibi's keys in my pocket, heading toward Claridge's, I felt for the second time in my life fresh born. I was not Sherwin's sleeves, nor Arthur Beryl Bane, taking step after step down a black street beneath blue stars. I was the unnamed, uncreated, vital force. And it was not that being the person named Sherwin Sleeves was something I could not put down, but rather, all along, it had been something that could never be picked up. Like air falling through one's fingers, there was nothing to catch hold of. And yet it was this illusion that I'd fought so hard to inhabit. Life itself went walking down the street. Unspectacular, soft, dull, awake, vibrating, simple, bright. Life, alive, living as it lived.
In Dublin's fair city, where the girls are so pretty, I first laid my eyes on sweet Molly Malone. As she wheeled her wheelbarrow through the streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive. She was a fishmonger, and sure 'twas no wonder, for so was her father and mother before. And they all wheeled their barrows through the streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, 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 oh, alive, alive, oh, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. She died a fever, and no one could save her, and that was the end of sweet Molly. Ghost wheels her barrow through the streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels.
You've been listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.